Confused by this optional gospel that they give. It says I could read this other gospel in year A when the above gospel is read on Monday, but we didn't have this gospel on Monday, so something strange about this. Anyway, let's go back to Sunday. I noticed, if you get the Animal Way, you notice on the front cover of the current issue, there's the image of the Transfiguration. And like most artistic representations of the Transfiguration, there's the glowing, glorious part on the top, and then down below there's the apostles falling to the ground and, you know, in their confusion and awe and fear. And it's a kind of a image of heaven and earth. You know, like a lot of religious artwork, there's heaven and earth, or the upper realm and the lower realm. And this particular version of it is very clear, even without even seeing it from a distance. You can see the glowing yellow in the top half and the kind of dark earthy colors on the bottom half. And the reason why I point that out, partly because we just did celebrate the Transfiguration, and that is a glimpse of heaven on earth, a glimpse of the glory of God present in our midst. But convergence is constantly on display in the life and ministry of Jesus, because he's heaven on earth. He's God and man. He's God in the midst of man. He's God united with man. And so heaven and earth come together in Jesus Christ. Well, that's what he really shows us here. They thought he was man. He was man. He is man. But he's also God. And this is a glimpse of his divine glory. And then there's, of course, Moses and Elijah. And Moses shows up in today's first reading and described as someone who speaks to God face to face. Well, here's an example of it. He's speaking to Jesus face to face. Okay, so this idea of heaven and earth being united in Jesus Christ, to reflect on this before we get to these other reflections from the readings, let me just mention something about St. Dominic and his ministry. St. Dominic in the early part of the 13th century encountered this heresy we know as the Albigensian heresy. Sometimes they describe them as the Cathars. And my memory of this history is a little bit vague, but I think if you know this, the Albigensians, because they believed that matter was evil, they believed in they were dualists. So spiritual life was good and was controlled by God. Matter was evil and was controlled by an evil God. So there was this conflict between spirit and matter, between the two principles of reality. Dualism, really. And so, because they believed matter was evil, they were very ascetical. They lived in poverty. They abstained. They promoted celibacy. They forsook all kinds of luxuries and certain kinds of foods, and really impressive way of life. Whereas the church leaders in that time, in particular, both in the bishops and the priests and the monks, were living, for the most part, very luxurious lives. To be a priest or to be a monk was really to be in great security and prosperity. And you've seen, I'm sure, pictures or representations. They're a little bit stereotypical, but the big fat monk with the big bottle of wine and the big chunk of meat in his hand. And they're like, it's stereotype, but not completely wrong. Maybe you know in stories of the other saint of this period, Saint Francis of Assisi, how he also ran into this the luxury and the power of the church. And he, because he was called to poverty, made a very deliberate choice not to go that way. Well, so did Dominic. But getting back to the Albigensians, because they were so ascetical, they were very believable. They were attracted a lot of followers because these people live according to what they believe. And it looked like a lot of the Catholics were not living according to what they believe. Now, we don't believe matter is evil, and we don't reject matter because it's evil. We can abstain and we can limit the satisfaction of our appetites because we know we're called to something higher, but not because there's anything wrong with eating, nothing wrong with marriage, nothing wrong with with comforts of this world. It's just that we don't get trapped in them. So the Catholic approach is not good versus evil, but good and better. You know, God made everything good, but he made us for something better. That's why this image is probably more helpful. Now, we're made for glory, and what we are passing through here is our journey to glory. But God is still at work right here in the nitty gritty and details of life. Okay, so there's these Albigensians, and they're becoming a very popular heresy, attracting people because they apparently lived according to what they believed. Well, Dominic saw this and said, well, we are, if we're going to combat this heresy, we also have to show by our way of life that we believe what we're preaching. And so he founded the Order of Preachers, that's the Dominicans, and they lived in a very simple, detached way of life. Now, not quite like the Franciscans, because the Dominicans understood that you have to study. You have to know what to say in order to convince people. So they were preachers. They were preachers. So, but they were first preaching by their way of life and then preaching by their teaching. So that was Dominic. Now, so we have that idea. In order to live according to what we believe, we don't have to reject what is material, because that's not what God does. And God created things because they're good. And there isn't any such thing as an evil God who controls matter. That's complete error. But our understanding of what's higher, I think, can help us understand what's going on here in today's gospel. Jesus, remember yesterday, after he heard about the death of John the Baptist, he withdrew to pray, but the crowds got there before him, and he ended up dealing with them all day, and then he multiplied the loaves. That was yesterday's gospel. Today he withdraws again. He goes, okay, now that I've fed the people, given them what they needed for this moment, I'm going to withdraw and pray. And he sent his disciples out in the boat. So again, Jesus exercising this higher life, this communion with the Father, he shows us this is part of life. You have to withdraw from this world and from activity in order to renew that communion with God. And Jesus does this often. He withdraws to pray. He does it again here, goes up to the mountain. The apostles go out in the boat, and they get caught up in their problems because it's a windy night, and they're not making any progress in the storm. So after he's done praying, or maybe when he saw that it was time to attend to his disciples, he goes walking toward them on the water. Now, walking on the water is not a natural thing. It's clearly, it's this level. It's not this level. This is sinking in the water, and this is walking on the water. So, and he must have been glowing because first of all, it was in the middle of the night, and you can't see, but they could see him, and so they thought he must be a ghost. And they were terrified. So there, the apostles living here, the same apostles. I mean, there's Peter, James, and John right here, same guys in the boat. And they see this phenomenon, which is unnatural, and say, well, this is a ghost. And Jesus says, no, take courage. It is I. Do not be afraid. Don't be afraid of the glory of God shining on the face of Jesus, because this is for you, not against you. This is actually about you. I'm here for you. I'm not here to frighten you and condemn you. And so Peter, in a very odd response, says, Lord, if it is you, if it's really you, you're not a ghost, tell me to come to you on the water. Tell me to come from here up to here. Like if you're saying you're here for me, well then, you know, kind of put your money where your mouth is and help me climb up out of this level and up to this level. I hope you don't mind me keep pointing to the cover of the book, but it's a real example of this. And Jesus says, come. Now in the Transfiguration, which is this image, Peter was struck and said, how good it is for us to be here. And now Jesus says, good for us to be up here. Come up on the water. And Jesus and Peter, no, it's not, this isn't the same image. Peter, one of these guys is Peter. I don't know which one, probably this one. So he comes up climbs out of the boat, starts walking on the water, which is obviously impossible to man, but is nothing's impossible to God. And then Peter looks around, realizes, I can't do this. I can't do it. He gets frightened, the wind and the waves, and he starts to sink back down to this level. And so, Lord, save me. Okay, cries out to this level, and then and Jesus reaches out his hand and saves him, catches him, brings him back into the boat. And then after that, there's no more image of glory. Jesus gets into the boat, and but they don't forget that this man who is God is now with them in the boat. And at the end of the gospel, it says here, not the very end of this passage, but it says here, when they got into the boat, they did him homage, saying, truly, you are the Son of God. Truly, you are the Son of God, but you're here in the boat with us now. And that's our faith. Yes, Jesus is the Son of God, in reigning in glory, but he's also here with us now in our boat, in our ordinary life. Now, the scripture scholars will point out that in Mark's version of this miracle, the apostles are completely astounded or amazed at Jesus' power over the wind and the waves. This gospel says they did him homage. Truly, you are the Son of God. And the scripture scholars love to try to make contrasts here. I don't see any contrast at all. In fact, I spoke about this last Saturday at the Day of Recollection. When we are amazed, our first reaction is to be dumbfounded. We don't even have words. That's what Mark describes when he says they were completely astounded. But once we start to engage the mind and what happened here, who is this? Then we start to say things like this, truly, you are the Son of God. So I don't see any conflict between Mark and Matthew. Okay, let's take a look, a brief look at this first reading where Miriam and Aaron, the older sister and the older brother of Moses, fall into the sin of jealousy. Again, the Old Testament has such great insight into human psychology. And here's another example of it. Jealousy in a family is a very common thing, especially when one member of the family rises up, and especially if it's your kid brother. Well, it's just almost intolerable to think that he's somehow surpassed you. So they come up with this, it even says here, a pretext. On the pretext of his marriage to a foreigner, they speak against him. It's not really about his marriage to a foreigner. It's that they feel like they've been surpassed by their little brother, and they say, "Well, what? Who is he? I mean, aren't we also good? Doesn't the Lord speak through us also?" So it was jealousy, blatant case of jealousy. Moses, because he's a humble man, and because he speaks to God face to face, he doesn't defend himself. He doesn't fight against them and try to show that he's the one. God is the one who takes Moses' part and says, okay, you three, come into the principal's office, and we have a little talk here. It's exactly what parents do when the kids are squabbling, or exactly what the principal does or the boss does when there's problems in the office. Okay, come into the office, let's settle this thing. And so that's what he does. He calls Aaron, Miriam, and Moses into the office, into the meeting tent, and explains the difference between Moses, who's a chosen leader. He has God's favor, and this is the way it is. There's nothing against Miriam and Aaron, but Moses is the one. He beholds the presence of God. And then there's this affliction. Who knows why it's only Miriam and not Aaron? But anyway, Miriam gets the leprosy, but Aaron is the one who's moved to concern for her. So perhaps that's why the Lord did it this way. I don't know. There's something mysterious about how the effects of sin come upon us. And we're all sinners, but we don't all have the same consequences in practical ways. Some people get sick, some people don't. And it's not because they're worse sinners than anyone else. It's just God revealing to us our dependence on him. So one of the things that happens when people get sick, and I was sick 2 weeks ago, so I know how this happens, people are moved to compassion for you. So it's terrible to be sick, but it actually does other people a lot of good, because They get out of themselves and they start being concerned for the sick person. Well, that's what happens to Aaron. Instead of trying to rise up against Moses, he looks at Miriam and says, oh no, we can't, please, we've been in the wrong, and please don't let her suffer this. Now, the reading leaves us hanging. She does get healed later, so I don't know why they skip over that part, but it's not as if God had, you know, an eternal judgment against Miriam. He was just teaching them all a lesson. Now, Moses didn't need the lesson, but Miriam and Aaron did. And this is why, because Miriam and Aaron are down here and they're thinking, oh, we have to climb up there ourselves because look where Moses is. And the Lord is saying, yeah, I want you up here too, but you can't do it like that. I'm the one who says, come. You don't pull him down and climb up yourself. You accept God's plan for all of us to be glorified, but it's God's plan. And if you try to do it yourself, you end up corrupting yourself. That's the leprosy is image of corruption, image of sin. Okay, so maybe that's too complicated, but the idea here is, yes, God is glorious and he wants us to be glorious. He actually is calling us to glory. The way to glory is humble submission, faith, trust in God, letting him be in charge. If he wants us to be in a storm, we'll be in a storm. If he wants us to walk on water, we walk on water. Because it all depends on him, not on us. And we're not climbing up on our own strength into glory. We are responding to the call of God to be his disciples, to be his children, to be his glorious brothers and sisters in heaven.